Today, we'll be talking about error propagation. That's the subject of today. But before we do so, I will just briefly touch upon yesterday's exercise. So yesterday, we had about central limit theorem, why things are Gaussian. And the point of the exercise was for you to see that as you mix in numbers from, well, at least a uniform and an exponential distribution, they tend toward Gaussian. However, if you put in numbers from a Cauchy distribution, it doesn't converge. And that is because the Cauchy distribution has two long tails. It simply doesn't have a defined standard deviation. It's a renowned distribution that is known for not having that. So that ruins everything. And also there was a division by a square root n, which was to keep the resulting Gaussian in being, well, not only centered at zero, having mean zero, but having a standard deviation of one, so that one can just draw a Gaussian on top and see that it all matches. So I hope that you got, well, both introduced to the whole format of the course and also the type of exercises, and that it made sense, and that you now trust that mostly uncertainties are Gaussian or very close to. Today's subject is error propagation, and let's before we jump into it, I actually just want to start out by having you have a small poll. So I'm going to launch a poll now, and I want you to answer within the next 2 minutes. So you have 2 minutes to answer these three questions. And the second one is slightly hard. And the third one, I haven't talked about yet, but I will today. I just want to sort of touch upon your thoughts in how many significant digits do you put on and what is that even? Please, a minute and a half left. And if there are any urgent questions meanwhile, you're welcome to ask them now as we count down. The link for today's lecture, each lecture has its own link. And those are the ones you find in the week pages. So it's on the Tuesday. That was the one I copied into Absalon. So that's where you will find all the links, and I will not continue to send them every time. All right. 2 minutes have passed. Okay. I can see a quick count up of people submitting. Submit now within 15 seconds and let's end here. Yeah. All right. We'll end now. So, here are the answers, and let's go through them. First of all, what's the relation between the variance and the standard deviation? Yes, the variance is the standard deviation squared. Most of you got that right. And the variance is a measure which is sort of squared. That's why we use the standard deviation often, because it has the same unit as the mean. Now, the second question was tricky, because Well, we had about correlations, and the question is, do correlations stay the same if you do linear transformations? And the answer is that they're actually both invariant under a linear transformation. I know Pearson is, and that's what most of you have said here, but the thing is, under a linear transformation, the ranking does not change. Of course, you could do a linear transformation which was negative, and then all the rankings turn, but you still have the one that was top before becomes bottom in the other one, and then it's invariant. That was a tricky one and a tough one. And then for the final one, well, we'll talk about that later. I'm glad to see that people think that the second and the fourth option are the good ones. And I suspect that people have been looking at the second and the fourth and said, I'm not really sure which one to pick. They both look good. I would say the last one is not downright wrong, but there is a special extra thing that when you have a one first, you might want another digit. We'll return to that. I should have pushed share before I went through them. So here you see them. Yeah, the variance is the standard deviation squared. Both are invariant under linear transformations. That was mostly a math question. We won't use that. And thirdly, well, especially second is good, but fourth may be okay. And never mind, Sylvia, that you missed the poll. That was just to start. Now, let's go back and go to today's lecture. And today's lecture, main lecture, is on error propagation. Here, so error propagation is almost its own end subject. And that's why I just put it here in the grand view of the course. And the idea is, if you have something you're interested in, say the gravitational acceleration, well, you didn't measure that. You measured the length of a pendulum and the period of a pendulum. And those measurements have uncertainties. What is the resulting uncertainty on the gravitational acceleration? So that's the idea. And so you have a function y. Y is what you're interested in, but it's a function of maybe a complicated function of a lot of input measurements, x1, x2, x3. What is the uncertainty on y? And here it's written for just one variable. Let's start with that. So now we have the uncertainty on x, but we want the uncertainty on y. And the idea is that you...
Are we supposed to see something? It's just the front screen of the slides.
That's funny. You should see the slides.
Does anyone else?
Only see the front slide.
Yeah, only me too. Front slide.
Same.
All right. Well, that's an obvious no-go. Let me then try it in the usual way where I do not go to full screen. You see it now?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
That's better.
I'll start again and do it slightly more quickly. So error propagation is, well, its own subject. It's an end subject, you could say. It's a use. The idea being that if you have y, and that's the value you're interested in, and it's a function of either one or more variables, x, if you know the error on x, what is then the uncertainty in y? And the point being that what you do is you ask yourself, if I vary x a little bit, how much will I vary y? And that, of course, depends on the slope here. Because if the slope is very low, then y won't change much. Whereas if it's very steep, then y will change a lot. And for that reason, it's the derivative of y with respect to x times the uncertainty in x. And that's simply the idea in error propagation. Now, you should note the approximation here that we're looking at a function where the derivative doesn't vary too much over the interval that x has an uncertainty within. Of course, if y varied wildly within this interval, then the error propagation formula simply breaks down. It doesn't, well, you can't just do this because it doesn't have a fixed, near fixed derivative. So this is what you do. And what do? If you have several dimensions, well, then you say, well, I just take a Taylor expansion, meaning I do the trick I just did before in many dimensions. And in general, the uncertainty on, well, the variance on X or anything is X squared and then the average minus the average of X squared. This can also be written with expectation values. This is the expectation value of x squared, and this is the expectation value of x squared. Now, if we do that to the formula above, well, then the expectation value of this, well, since the x's are around the mean, this all cancels out. But when you do it squared, they don't cancel out, and you get this extra term. And when you subtract the two, you get the error propagation formula. Now, let's just go through it. So the, let's just say you have two values of x's. Well, then you have the uncertainty on y squared is the uncertainty on x. Well, the derivative with respect to x. And let's just take I to be the first variable and the first variable. Well, then it's the derivative squared times the uncertainty in x squared. So that's the formula we had to begin with, just everything squared. But there is also a cross term from when you take the derivative with respect to x and the x1 and derivative with respect to x2, and then the correlation between the two. And this is the covariance matrix. Now, if all the input values of x are uncorrelated, then this correlation matrix or covariance matrix is the true word, is diagonal. There's nothing in the off-diagonal terms. And so this boils down to this formula. And this is what I think most people would call the error propagation formula. This is the one where things are just not correlated. So it's the simpler one. And so you take the uncertainty in y squared is just a contribution of each of the x's. And how do you add things up? Well, you add things up, the variance you add up, which means the sigma squared. And there you have it. And this also means a little byproduct of this is the fact that, let's say you're measuring the gravitational acceleration with a pendulum, and you have the length of the pendulum and you have the period of the pendulum. Both of these come with an uncertainty. So there are two terms here. By looking at each term individually, you can see how much do I ruin my measurement from not knowing the length well, and the other term, how much do I ruin my measurement's precision by not knowing the period well. And so from this formula, you can actually know which things you should improve on. And that's what's noted here, namely that each term represents the individual contribution from each x on the uncertainty on y in this. And there are sort of two special cases of this. What if, well, maybe I should have written y here, x1 plus x2, but now I just do it so that the subscripts become easier. If you add two numbers, what is the uncertainty on x? Well, the uncertainty on x squared is the uncertainty on y, u squared plus the uncertainty on v squared. And this, what people say is that when you add numbers, the errors add in quadrature. So let's say the uncertainty on u is 3 and the uncertainty on v is 4. Well, then the uncertainty on x would be 5 if there was no correlation between the two. However, there can be a correlation, so you have to take this into account if there is one. And the more general is that, well, it might be that it has a slope to it. Well, then you have to take that into account and it enters like an AB here. Now, a quick question, and you can just, I'm not gonna do a poll on that. You can just right in the chat. You see here, now you have this term here and the covariance matrix, the covariance between two values can be negative. And so my question is, do you think you can get a negative value here?
No.
I'm glad to see a lot of no's. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And no, of course we can't get an error squared to be negative. That would be an imaginary uncertainty. What the hell is that? No, the point being that remember that we had rho was between minus one and one. Well, you can only make this term as big as the sum of these two. And so you can't get this to be below something. My second question is, can you get this uncertainty to be very small by having the result be a sum of two things which are highly correlated in a smart way? I get a lot of yeses. And the answer is yes, thank you. And in fact, the answer is, this is what all smart experimentalists know, and this is exactly how they try to set up an experiment so that the errors tend to cancel. I'll come with a simple show of how you can do that in a moment. Just let's take the multiplication. So what if x is u times v? Well, then we would have to take the derivative with respect to u. Well, that's v. And then the same here and over here. The thing is, you can divide by x squared in all of this, and x is u times v. And suddenly you get a formula which looks more like what you had before, namely, now it's the relative uncertainty squared which adds in quadrature. So if u has an error of 3%, so now it's a relative uncertainty, and v has an error of 4%, then x would have an uncertainty of 5% if there was no correlation. And with the correlation, you have to do special things, of course. Now, let's take simply a few examples of error propagation and how things can be done smart. One of the masters of it is actually John Harrison. And Harrison built a series of clocks for the British government at the time when Britain had a large empire, because they realized that the empire depended very much on being able to determine the longitude. Latitude you can get from measuring the height of the sun, and you knew which day it was. But for longitude, you need to know what time it is. And so he built clocks and in the end won the prize set out by Parliament. One of the things he did was to say, well, when the temperature changes, and these clocks were with pendulums and they needed to work at sea, the pendulum would expand with temperature, meaning the time would change with temperature. Well, he invented what's called the Gridian pendulum. Here's an example, but what it contains is that the length of the pendulum, well, it has iron in some bars, and then it doesn't touch so that you have sink on the way back, and then iron. And the length of these are calculated in exactly a way such that when temperature increases, these expand, and the pendulum becomes longer here, but a lot longer here on the shorter parts, and overall, it doesn't change the period of the pendulum. And this way you cancel out that uncertainty. So this was the smart thing that he was able to do and among those win the prize. Other error propagations done is that people were seeing that Uranus's orbit did funny things compared to the Newtonian predictions. And from that, and also using error propagation, Urbain Le Verrier, he sat down and he calculated if there was another planet, where should that be? And what's the uncertainty on my estimate? And it was about 1 degree, And lo and behold, when they looked where he pointed, they could see Neptune after a while. Neptune was discovered that way. And then people thought, that's smart. Are there other planets who don't move as they're supposed to? Mercury was a case. Mercury didn't move at it as it was supposed to. Its perihelion, so when it's closest to the sun, was actually moving at a rate which was unexplained. And so people went about and asked, you know, okay, what can change that? Well, the different planets can do it. And here's the effect on Mercury, and here's the effect on Earth. And the calculation turns out that, when you do it, you get large sums and you subtract. But note how carefully all the error propagation is done, so that even in the sum, you have a very small uncertainty. And you see for Earth, the effect is such that nothing happens really on Earth. It's within 2 sigma. So, you know, there's no nothing pointing at this not being just the coincidence. Remember, 1/3 of measurements should be outside 1 sigma. But for Mercury, the effect was really there. There is an effect, and it's not from the other planets. But with relativity, you could calculate the size of the effect, and the size calculated with this, and it corresponds beautifully with what the measurement has, including the uncertainty. So here's the importance of the uncertainty. If this had been plus minus 55, then of course that corresponds both to relativity and to a zero effect. I can say that the discovery of the Higgs particle was guided by the fact that one saw effects elsewhere which could be attributed to the Higgs particle. And from calculating backwards, it could be determined roughly what mass the Higgs particle should have. This is a plot from before the Higgs discovery, and the mass it was discovered at was 125, so that's here. And out here you will see the chi-square, the change in chi-square, which we will get to on Friday. Most of you will have met it before. When people do elaborate measurements, what they do is they actually show my uncertainty because of this is that much. My uncertainty because of this is that much, this, that much, so on. And in the end, they say, well, that's all my uncertainty. Adding these things in quadrature, if they are not correlated, and otherwise taking the correlations into account. And then they would say, well, all of these effects are, and we'll get to that later, things that have nothing to do with me taking more and more measurements. I'd get it wrong anyway. Whereas I also have a number from just a limited amount of data. That's called the statistical uncertainty. We will get more into that, don't worry. And then you add those two in quadrature, and here you have the error. And much of that, just propagating errors, is in fact what the project experiment is about. So there are two experiments, a pendulum and a ball rolling down an incline through 5 gates. We know what G is as a function of the input parameters, and now you should measure the input parameters and propagate it all through to G and know G has this uncertainty and this much is because of A, this much is because of R, this much is because of the angle, and so on. And one of the good things to do when you're doing error propagation anyway today is to sit down with, if you have a group, and if you don't, write Julia, please. It's to sit down and actually differentiate G with respect to each of these parameters and find out, okay, what does the error from each of these terms actually look like? And then finally, on today's exercise, the thing is, error propagation should always be done with the error propagation formula to begin with. But there times when simulation actually is a smart way out. And then you might say, simulation, how can I simulate my way out of that? Well, you can simply choose random values of the input parameters corresponding to the mean and standard deviation of each of these, and then calculate y that results from these input values, and then do it again and again and again. And at some point you have 100,000 values of y, or probably 1,000 will do. And the standard deviation on y reflects the impact of these different x's. And you can get the individual contribution by taking, saying, I fix all the x's except one, which I vary within the standard deviation. All the others take the value of the mean. That is much of what today's exercise is about. And the power of simulation is the fact that, hey, we've got fast computers. It's not hard to do this. And it turns out that in cases where the error propagation formula breaks down, the simulation will see it. Because who knows, you might not get a Gaussian uncertainty out at all. And you can't, that's hard to check what the distribution will look like in from the error propagation formula. But when you simulate this, then you can see it. And also, let's say that you have not any short, simple expression that you can differentiate, but that you have a long expression that is super hard and sucks to differentiate and, you know, give something several pages out. How about simulating it? It's a quick and, well, a slightly dirty way of doing it. And finally, it's a good way of cross-checking that your calculation from the error propagation formula actually works. Yeah, that was what I had on error propagation. I'm not done yet, but I wanted to ask if there are any questions. No? Clear and simple? Well, that's cool. You can think about them still and write them in the chat if it is. Then I have a question. Whoops, there was a question. Are you going to talk more on different types of simulations? Jakob asks. And the answer is yes, I will, a lot. Actually picking numbers, random numbers from a distribution of what you want is a small art in itself that we will get into. For now, we just pick numbers from a Gaussian distribution, because that's what we assume the input parameters have, x, and that's what we'll do for now. And the other question was, how did the pendulum in Harrison's clock eliminate error? Well, it eliminated error from temperature, because when temperature change, then so would the length of the pendulum. But the length of Harrison's pendulum did not change, or in fact, the moment of inertia, because as the iron expanded, so did the zinc, and the zinc expanded more, pulling the pendulum up instead of down, whereas the iron put it down. And of course, he chose the length to cancel out. Does this have anything to do with Monte Carlo? Yeah, Monte Carlo is actually just simulating your way out of things. And Simone asks, if the error is not Gaussian, how would you write it down? Well, for that, there is no recipe. If it's not Gaussian, it can have any distribution. And typically, you'd simply show a histogram of what it looks like. So I have a question to you, and you can write me in private if it's a problem. But people asked, I don't know anybody on this course, and I'd like to find someone to collaborate with. For all those who submitted to the questionnaire, that was 112 in total. So there are at least 24 sinners who didn't do it. The questionnaire is linked to the front page of the course, and I still urge you to fill it out. So, but I would like to make public a list of all your names, first and last name, how many years you studied, and what field slash direction you've taken. And I wanted to put that on the course webpage if nobody complains, because then those who don't have a group can look through that and say, hey, there's somebody who either studies the same or has studied the same amount of time, is doing a PhD or what, let me team up with the person. So yeah, if you don't mind me publishing that, then I will do that during the exercises. So you have between now and then to write me if that's a problem. Okay, then I just want to say something briefly about, you don't have to write me a mail saying it's fine by you. It's only if it's not fine publishing. Then I want to talk shortly about significant digits. Oops, that was not the one I wanted to show. Oops, it is. All right. Reporting results and significant digits. And well, the way it's scientifically correct to report results is in the following way. You write, you find out your uncertainty, and then you quote that uncertainty with only a single digit here. I'll get back to an exception. And then you write the value here with the same number of digits or the same precision. And the reason for that is that reporting more numbers here on the main result, that's, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would you want to put that if the uncertainty is already such that the four is highly uncertain, right? The next digit is random, more or less. So that's why you don't put more digits on the main result. And why not put more digits on the error? For example, why not write 240 meters plus minus 50 meters? You know, that could be one of the things you would contemplate. But then people would think that you established the uncertainty with a precision of two digits for the uncertainty. And uncertainties are notoriously hard to establish. So that's why we rarely do that. I would say when you publish a scientific result, unless you look deeply into the uncertainty, put only one digit. However, in this course, it's allowed to put two digits, also so that we just can see if we numerically get the same result. Because if you do the rounding, then you might have different values, but you can't see it because you rounded it. So, but that's why we write this. And I should say, this reads that the mean is that, and the uncertainty on the mean, if this is a mean, but it's the uncertainty on that number that is this value, okay? And unless otherwise specified, this is the Gaussian uncertainty. And a fun thing is, in, I would say in science, we always quote plus minus one sigma. In medicine, there's a tradition for doing plus minus two sigma. Don't ask me why, but I'm just warning you, that's the way they do it. And then it might be that part of your uncertainty is from lack of data, and part of it is because of outside factors that you can't control. And dividing the error into those two is actually considered highly professional. Yeah. And then finally, just on the last digit, see, here is a calculation of the uncertainty on the uncertainty. It follows the approximate rule here. And so you need thousands of measurements typically in order to establish the second digit in your uncertainty. And that is why we typically don't put it. However, the exception, possible exception, is if the first digit of the uncertainty is a one. Because if it's one, then it could have been 0.06. It could have been half the error and could also have been 50% above. And well, within that range, you probably know the uncertainty that it's not that. So if the first digit of your uncertainty is a one, then it's okay to put another digit. But as I said, in this course, we'll allow for one extra digit overall for comparison reasons, not for publishing. Okay. And with that, I actually thought of asking if there are any questions. And when we're done with that, I'll introduce today's exercise, and that is it. And meanwhile, I see that I missed Julia's question. To integrate an independent variable, does that, since it is sort of continuous sums, mean error goes to infinity? Well, if y depends on x, and x can be anything going to infinity, and y depends linearly on x, then I would say, then you don't know anything about y either. But I suspect that was not the question. I see a little more here. Do people do the error propagation thing often, or is it more in particle physics thing? Well, that they do often, I would say. And the error propagation formula is a standard thing in doing experiments. You need to be able to say, this is an input parameter that I don't know perfectly. And I'd love to see, also outside particle physics, those who come and say, I calculated y, and all the input values x, I know perfectly. No. It's a very common thing. Even in political science, and I would say when it reaches that far, then it's used everywhere. All right, I see Susanna concur with me. Lucky. Yeah. All right. If that's it, then the last thing I'll share is my
tools.
Yeah, please.
Just ask a quick question. in regards to this, how does like normal confidence intervals and like prediction intervals relate to this error propagation thing? Because
thanks for the question. The it links to that when you get y with a certain uncertainty, let's say you get y equals 10 plus minus 1. Well, then a confidence interval of 95%, 95 corresponds to 2 sigma. Well, then you would know with 95% confidence that the true answer lies somewhere between 8 and 12. That was the simple answer. But then it might be, well, I'm looking at red cars on Blydamsvej and I just observed 20 cars and I saw no red cars. Does this mean that there are no red cars ever on Blydamsvej? The answer is no. What confidence interval can I set? That is the subject 3 weeks time from now. We'll get to that.
Great, thanks.
But we need a few more building blocks to explain exactly what you do there.
Truls?
Yes.
And about this confidence interval, like the problem with the cars you just mentioned, it sounds to me like the problem of induction in a theory of science.
We'll get to it because it becomes a longer explanation without anything supporting visually if I do it here. So let's wait.
Yes.
All right. Before we dash off to today's exercise, let me just show it. Can you see my screen now?
Yes.
Yes. Well, here's the error propagation. And if you haven't done it already, then here's the reference. And this is one of the few exercises where I want you to do something analytically first. Namely, imagine that you had been sitting in Auditorium A, and now at least most of you have been there, and you say, I can visually say, the length of that table is probably 3.5 meters, and the width of it is probably 80 centimeters, and you assign some uncertainties to that. Then the question is, can you know what the perimeter, so how far around the table there is, the area of the table, and the diagonal length of the table with uncertainty from knowing these two and knowing the correlation. And I want you to calculate that starting with no correlation and then redoing it with correlation in. And I want you to do it analytically first. And once you've done that, then I want you to solve the same problem by doing it with simulation. I want you to feel confident that you can always propagate uncertainties through, and that you can check if it works, and you can see if things come out Gaussian or not, and you can do it for advanced formulas. And at the end, I can just show you that, well, I would consider this slightly advanced formula. This is one where it sucks to do the integration, the differentiation. And then one more thing. As a first, we decided to put in SymPy, symbolic Python. And in symbolic Python, you can define your variables, and then you can actually do differentiation with respect to different variables. P differentiated with respect to L. And you can get values out. Well, you can get formulas out, and you can also get values out. And I urge you to use that. From what I've seen so far, and the other TAs tended to agree with me, it looks like a really nice way of solving this. I know you probably have Mathematica and Mabel and Wolfram Alpha and whatnot, but it's nice to have it within the notebook that you're working on, that you have the solutions there. Also for future theses and publications and whatnot. Yeah?
Can I ask a question, Troels?
Please.
So I don't really have an idea, like what's the difference between doing error propagation analytically or like the other ways? What does analytically even mean?
Analytically mean with the error propagation formula, meaning that you could do it on a piece of paper. Yeah?
Uh-huh.
Whereas doing it by simulation, that you can't do on a piece of paper. A computer is very good for that. And this is where you pick random numbers, the x's according to their distribution, you calculate y, and then you see what distribution does y come out to have.
Cool.
Did that explain it, Marcus?
Yes.
Super. All right. Well, if
it's all
further, then I think we should dash off to exercises.
Rules. I have one question about the exercise.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't really there yesterday, so I came too late. But do we need to like outline the exercises somewhere, or just do it ourselves?
Nope. I said that yesterday, hopefully loud and clear. The exercises are for you to learn from. We will post solutions to some degree, but they are you don't need to hand in anything from the exercises at all.
Okay, thank you.
Calmly through the questions and feel that you feel comfortable in answering them. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, but the MT exercises are more like of a programming training, right?
The MT exercises, to also repeat from yesterday, are for those who want to try to program and make a solution themselves and not use whatever code we provide.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
Cool. 59. We're on time. As always, we don't keep the doors closed, so just come to Frederiksberg. We will also find our way there. We officially start 2:30, and that is still an unofficial start because we don't do much or say anything until 3:00. So let's reconvene where you were yesterday and in the same groups, and also work out if you have groups for the project, then we would love to hear that. And that's it. Thank you very much. Signing off. See you in Frederiksberg.